You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the 24th to the 30th of July 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Holly Else and Jack Grove, news editor Simon Baker and writer Matthew Rice. Universities and unions are on a collision course over pensions, our lead news story reveals this week. 130,000 staff could lose their final salary pension, see it replaced with a career average scheme. More on that in just a second. Around 4 years ago, then HE Minister David Willetts said universities would charge 9k fees only in exceptional circumstances. That's not quite how it's worked out, as we'll find out in just a moment. Grant application success rates at four research councils have taken a nosedive. Holly will tell us a bit more on why shortly. And who's the most famous alumnus of Pembroke College, Oxford? Of course, it has to be Professor X, leader of the X-Men. And our cover feature this week looks at academics in comics and in graphic novels. Matthew will elaborate a little later in the podcast. But Jack, first up, pensions. It's an issue that comes around pretty regularly. Why has it reared its head this week?
Higher education pensions can be a bit of a dry subject, but this is actually the subject is going to get quite bloody, it seems, over the next few months, because the universities have unveiled plans to end the final salary pension for all academics. And this is what is seen as quite a generous pension scheme and one of the perks of being an academic, many say. And the universities say they can no longer afford to offer this. The estimated deficit is believed to be about £13 billion. Unless they do something very radical, the system's just not going to hold up anymore. So they want to move staff to a career average scheme, which is generally far less generous, and unions are saying they're very unhappy about this, that they don't agree with the formula being used, and they are readying for strike action to basically stop it happening.
I mean, there's been strikes over this in the past, of course. How likely is it that tactic will be employed?
It's difficult this time, because back in 2011, when university staff walked out about pensions, there was this same proposal was on the table, end-to-end final salaries schemes, and eventually the proposals were watered down, so only new entrants were moved to career average. Now, because of that, you've basically split the academic sector in two, so why should a younger academic on a career average go on strike to save someone else's final salary pension scheme that they don't themselves get? So the politics are going to be quite interesting. The detail of what's being proposed is going to be coming out in the autumn and in early 2015, and it'll be interesting to see what's on the table, how generous the career average scheme is, and whether it can compare in any way to the final salary.
I mean, just one point I just wanted to ask about this, really, Jack, was if an academic, say 45, for instance, has suddenly moved on to this, you know, they lose their final salary scheme, they move on to this new scheme. Yeah. What happens to the benefits they've kind of accrued under the final salary scheme so far? Do they still get those?
The benefits already accrued are safe, so they're, yeah, you can't really change those. But obviously, you've only worked halfway towards retirement, so. Yeah. The value wouldn't be as great as if you stayed in it, so you could have half of your pension pot as of under final salary terms and half under career average terms. So basically in my piece, one pension expert says that the people who are under 50 are really the people who are going to be hardest hit. Those people over 50 have probably accrued enough to get a decent pension going, but those people under 50 and below, and, you know, much younger, will be harder hit.
It's like under 50's the country over, though, isn't it? I mean, it's not a problem in academia, is it? It's a problem in the population more widely, that the young'uns haven't planned ahead, and the old uns can rest easy.
Well, that's true. I mean, people say that the fact that USS have put off these changes for so long means the situation is so bad there's going to have to be something really drastic happening, and action should have been taken sooner. But yeah,
we'll see how it pans out. Alongside that article this week, that's on page 6 and 7. On page 7, it's a story that's headlined Wrong Again. The top line is, to the list of history's spectacularly inaccurate predictions, one more can now be added. Simon, what is that prediction?
Well, it may have something to do with tuition fees.
No.
Well, it's, I suppose it's no surprise, and we've written before about the fact that so many universities ended up charging 9k. I mean, the reason why it's a false prediction is because the government famously said, just after they brought in the plans for the 9k fee cap, that it would only be in exceptional circumstances that universities would be able to charge 9k. Of course, it quickly became apparent that rather than an exceptional circumstance, most universities were going to end up charging at least some courses at 9k. Over the last kind of few years, that slowly drifted towards being everyone, and you know, not a lot of people will be surprised about that. For a couple of years, it was kind of, we've written this story almost every year, but it was more than half, then it was kind of 9 out of 10. Yeah, now we're talking about, out of the universities that charge more than 6k, they're the ones that actually have to send something called an access agreement to the office, a fair access, to prove that they're doing enough to help poorer students. So they have to have that approved, and then they say also this is what our fee is going to be. So from though, among those universities, which is most English universities actually, I mean, there are exceptions, like the Open University charges less than six, the equivalent of less than six, but for those universities there's now only two that aren't charging at least one course at 9k.
Yeah, that's University College Birmingham and the University of Sunderland. Those are the two.
Yeah, so I mean, I'd love to sort of one day kind of just go back and maybe for this podcast play some of the speeches that were made in the House of Commons just before those student protests about exceptional circumstances. And really, if you look at it on that level, it is as bad as the Lib Dems pledge before the election, in a way. I mean, it's just a prime example of kind of policy being made kind of quite quickly on the hoof and promises being made, which clearly have turned out to be, everyone knew at the time, it was just completely unrealistic, and, well, what a surprise.
No, interesting stuff. That's page 7. Completing our roundup of the lead news pages this week, Holly, is your piece on grant application. Now, grant application success rates have been on the up in recent years, but figures from the Research Council suggest that's changing.
Yeah, it looks like it. So we've got some details of success rates for what's called responsive mode funding, which is more often known as curiosity-driven research. That's when a researcher has an idea and writes into the funding council, the Research Council, sorry, for funds to pursue it. And we've seen in four Research Council annual reports that the success rate has fallen this year for, in some cases, the first time in several years. Now, the biggest drop has been about 14%. That's at the Arts and Humanities Research Council. But another drop of 8% at the Natural Environment Council, and then 2% at the Economic Research Council, and 1% at the Medical Research Council. And they've sort of given various reasons as to why this might be. They're saying there's perhaps less money available in 2013-14 than there had been in the previous year. Also that researchers are asking for bigger grants, so therefore they can give out less of them in number because there's less money to go around, and that there's been an increase in the number of people asking for money. But it also points to the fact that Research Council's demand management activities might be failing.
So that's where they weed out the poorer applications before they even get to that
point.
Yeah,
so this is where the burden is on universities to sort of only send in their best chance proposals, if you like. And it could point to perhaps more of those activities in the years ahead for universities.
Interesting stuff. Well, as I say, all of those stories we've discussed so far on page 6 and 7, the main news flash this week. And Matthew, on to you. The artwork on the cover this week is a wonderful spandex-clad academic flying through the air, fist raised, saying, "How's that for impact?" What's that all about?
Well, I just thought it would be fun to look at academics in comic books and graphic novels. We've often had pieces about the sort of campus novel, and this seemed like a sort of interesting extension. And you get the traditional superhero comics. You get, you know, scientists who have some sort of accident in the lab and they turn blue and radioactive, or the size of an ant, and go off saving the world and so on. And the strange thing, well, to me it seems strange, is that some of them, you know, actually have quite detailed academic CVs. Mm. And you think nothing else about these books is in the least bit realistic, but actually they've got their academic CV. So if they, you know, ever got bored with saving the world, they could, you know, go back to their original day job as an academic. Mm. And I went on from there, sort of thinking, well, are there more realistic portrayals of academics in graphic novels and memoirs? And, you know, I came up with some pretty interesting examples. There's Mayan Satrapi's book, Persepolis, which is a memoir of growing up in Iran. And when she went to art school, they first were doing life drawing. And first they were drawing women, but they were all sort of like black monoliths. So it was all just like learning how to draw curtains. You couldn't see a bit of the body underneath. And then they had male models, and that seemed a bit more interesting. But there was this, you didn't need it. You're allowed to draw from male models, but you're not allowed to look at them. Right. So the sort of problems of you know, academic life in Iran, obviously, is one thing. And then we go on to things like a book called Logic Comics, which is about the philosopher Bertrand Russell's attempt to establish the foundations of mathematics, and he took him over 300 pages to prove that 1 plus 1 equals 2. And the authors then are sort of speculating about whether it was kind of some forms of philosophy sort of drive you slightly mad, or whether it's people who are slightly mad and obsessive who go into it in the first place. So I think there are some slightly more believable academics to be found in some of the more recent graphic novels. I also found an academic who said that it was reading Spider-Man comics which spurred him to become a philosopher. So so there you go.
Fascinating stuff. And as I said, there's some great illustration from David Parkins as well that we've commissioned for this piece, which is worth checking out.
I think it's interesting how you have superheroes springing from academia. Academia is obviously seen as a very sort of rigid structure which these colourful characters can really spring out of, whereas maybe sort of in cities it's all a bit busy and people can get lost, while in academia you know they really maybe stand out and can use their...
Yeah, I think that's partly it, and partly, you know, anything can happen to you in a lab if things happen to go wrong one afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Great stuff. Well, the other feature this week I should mention is written by Jack here and Paul Jump as well, which looks at how university expansion might affect the relationship between town and gown. But that's all we've got time for in this week's podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, or indeed any articles in this week's magazine, you can do so at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, even on Google+. So if you've got anything to say, there's plenty of ways for you to get in touch. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.